Part 2. Reconstruction. Chapter 10. The landscape of Deliverance was dominated by a kilometer-high needle at the centre of the workshops. Once this had been the infamous Black Tower, the main citadel of Kiavar's guards. Now it was called Ravenspire. Spotlights from dozens of gantries pierced the black void, shining down upon transport ways and sprawling mineheads. Defence turrets studded its surface, guided by gleaming sensor lenses in armoured niches, arrayed like the eyes of a fly. Korax's Stormbird descended over the sprawl of the ancient prison towards one of the eight landing aprons that jutted from Ravenspire like grey fungi on a black stalagmite, each surrounded by the pale glow of an energy field. Looking at the maze of prison wings and guardhouses, it would be an observer's first thought that the moon's facilities were in disrepair. Rockreed housings and metal panels covered the surface of the buildings like patchwork, while some areas were left blasted and burnt, open to the airless vacuum of space. Force domes glittered in the starlight, protecting clusters of high-rise cell blocks, fuel storage tanks and ore transport hubs. The appearance of Deliverance was deceptive. All damage caused during the rebellion and the subsequent counterattack by the guilds had been fully repaired. Not a crack leaked air, nor a door seal was broken. By order of Korax, the settlement bore its scars as reminders of those who had died to free the moon colony from the oppressive tyrants on the planet below, as long as such affectations did not compromise safety or security. As Korax gazed down through the port of the Stormbird, he could remember every single rupture and ruin as if they had been wounds on his own flesh. The dropship passed over Wing 8, where he had lived with Antonu, and where the rebellion had truly begun. The once majestic 12th gate that linked Wing 8 to the Ravenspire bore the marks of the bombs that had been planted by his guerrillas to trap the guards who had come flowing out of the central spire, welts of darker plasfoam that filled the cracks like scar tissue. Nafrim Salt, a 13-year-old girl, had sacrificed herself to detonate the last of the charges to bring down the arching gateway on the reinforcements. Wing 7 was all but a ruin. Burnt-out cells with empty windows stared into the blackness. 4,000 inmates had perished there, scourged by a fireball unleashed when the guards detonated the main gas supply. Korax had not anticipated this, and it was with bitter memories that he looked down at the blackened shell of the prison wing. It had taken more than a year to recover all of the bodies from the ash, babes and elders for the most part. Wing 7 having been a low-security administrative complex. Korax had scoured the security logs to find out the man responsible and had tracked down Corporal Theod Norrock 4 days later. The Primarch's revenge had been drawn out, a moment he was not proud of, but which had brought him a small sense of satisfaction at the time. Only one building stood out as much as Ravenspire, connected by a silvery tunnel to the main edifice. The castle-like structure, with peaked roof and corner turrets, gleamed in the light of the setting star, silver and obsidian, a marvel of imperial engineering. It was formerly called the Primary Administration Corps, but to the inhabitants outside its shining walls, it was known as the Tax Keep. Korax would be addressing those who worked within later that night, but he had more pressing business to attend to first. The Stormbird passed through the energy canopy of High Dock, Korax's view becoming one of yellow static for a moment. He turned away from the window as the Stormbird's jets whined into the final descent. "Do you know what you're going to say?" asked Bran, sitting opposite the Primarch. "I foresee it causing trouble, Lord." "Not yet," replied Korax. "Not every word. They will have to deal with a reality. There is no avoiding what must be done."
"It's a complication we could do without," said the Commander of Recruits.
Korax agreed, but made no further comment. The dropship touched down with a screech of metal landing pads on the ferrocrete.
"A necessary action," muttered Korax, standing up as the dropship settled into place.
The door hissed open behind him.
"One that I would have performed without Malkador's insistence."
The pair departed the Stormbird and made their way the short distance to the Carnivalis,
a hall near the bottom of Ravenspire that had been used for large gatherings of the Legion. It was part feasting chamber and part reliquary of the Legion's many victories. Trophies of all kinds, weapons, skulls, armour, banners, even pieces of wall and armoured doors of enemy citadels, were hung upon the walls. There was little organisation to the display, which had once led iterator Sirmis Iconialis to remark that it looked more like the nest of a magpie than a raven. That same individual now waited with 156 other men and women in the Carnivalis, having been summoned there by Korax as the Avenger had attained orbit. Along with his fellow iterator, Loke Nastabrite, Iconialis was accompanied by Deliverance's remembrances. Artists, poets, pictographers, sculptors and journalists gazed at Korax with a mixture of apprehension, suspicion and expectation as the Primarch entered the vast hall. The small crowd was dwarfed by its surroundings and had gathered about the stage area and lectern at the far end of the hall, forcing Korax to walk the length of the Carnivalis before he could address them. He strode up the stairs to the stage, easily taking the steps four at a time, and turned towards the assembled remembrances. "You are all to return to your quarters, pack up your personal belongings, and prepare to leave Deliverance," he said. The announcement was met with shouts of condemnation, groans, pleas, and general hubbub. "Quiet! I have not finished." The crowd was stilled as Korax raised his hand for silence. "Take everything. You will not be returning. All materials you have been compiling for the remembrancing are to be handed over to Commander Bran. You and your luggage will be searched thoroughly. Do not attempt to smuggle out even a few rough notes or a doodled cartoon. Everything is to be delivered to Bran." This caused further outcry, which Korax had been expecting. He caught the gaze of Iconialis, who gave a slight nod of understanding and turned to face the distraught and angry remembrances. He lifted his hands, stilling the tumult. "Pray silence for the noble Primarch," said Iconialis, his voice clear and precise, cutting through the few lingering grumbles and whispers. "I am sure there is good cause for this action. Let us not forget that it is by the grace of Lord Korax that we have remained here."
"Thank you, iterator," said Korax.
He folded his arms and ran through what he had to say. Malkador's last communication before the Avenger had left orbit had been to dissolve the Order of Remembrances and send them back to Terra for debriefing, in accordance with the Edict of Dissolution. The Sigilite had made it clear that Korax was not to discuss in detail the events that were currently overtaking the Imperium. He had also acknowledged that some explanation was necessary and had furnished the Primarch with a few preferred phrases to convey what had happened. Korax dismissed the suggestions, preferring to say things in his own way.
"Horus has rebelled against the Emperor," he said.
There was no point in keeping the situation secret. Better that Korax told the remembrances the bald facts than they heard half-truths and rumours. He waited, expecting another storm of surprise and protest, but instead his words were met with shocked silence.
"You may have heard before Commander Bran left Ravenspire that a force of the Legiones Astartes had been dispatched to confront the War Master at Istvan. That confrontation did not end well. The Emperor gathers his forces and the Raven Guard will be amongst them. We cannot offer you protection here, so you would be removed from Deliverance and returned to Terra."
"I come from Assyri,"
called out a bearded man with a long cowl and paint marks on the sleeves of his loose tunic. Unlike his warriors and legion attendants, Korax had never bothered to learn the names of most of the remembrances, seeing them as an inconvenience at the best of times and an irritation and distraction at the worst.
"I don't want to go to Terra."
This was followed by several similar protests.
"It is not for you to decide," said Korax. "We are not going to shuttle each of you back to your preferred choice of destination. You will all go back to Terra for debriefing by the offices of Malkador the Regent. There will be no exceptions."
"Why do you want all our work?"
asked a young woman with a pictograph unit hanging on a strap around her neck.
"We've worked for years gathering that material."
"Intelligence," Korax replied bluntly. "Many of you have mingled with remembrances attached to other legions, particularly the Lunar Wolves. We will examine your accumulated material for insights into Horus's rebellion."
He did not add
that the remembrancers had chronicled most of the Raven Guard's accomplishments and victories, as well as the defences of Deliverance. He could not risk the ship transporting the remembrancers being taken by a traitor vessel with such information on board.
"Just how bad is this?"
asked Iconialis, his voice losing its usual timbre, hushed with worry.
"I mean, I do not know what to say. I can scarcely believe it."
"I won't lie to you, Iterator. War is coming, like nothing you've ever seen. A war that will tear the galaxy apart. A war between the Legiones Astartes." The prisoner waited patiently, bemused by his incarceration. He sat on a plain chair that was almost too small for him, dressed in a simple grey robe. He was being kept in an empty storage room not far from Alpha Terminal near the summit of Ravenspire. Korax had ordered the old punishment cells sealed forever after the revolution, and it had seemed pointless to open up one of the vacant wings for one legionary. On a world that had once housed nearly 10 million prisoners, the massive warrior looked incongruous amongst the metal shelves and cabinets. There was still a mop and bucket in the corner. Agapito stood to one side of the closed door, Solaro on the other. The commanders stared directly ahead, not looking at their charge. Agapito did so only with immense self-control, and knew that Solaro felt the same. That the prisoner was still alive was a testament to the discipline of the legionaries that had returned directly from Istvan. He had been taken into custody and treated with a level of dignity that many of them had not known as inmates of Lycaeus. Korax had taught them that there was no honour in heaping the suffering they had endured on others. A spoken word from the legionary standing outside heralded the arrival of the Primarch. Korax had been forced to deal with the remembrancers first, but this matter had been raised between the Primarch and his commanders on the return to Deliverance. Agapito opened the door, unsure what his master intended, as Korax ducked through, instantly filling the small room with his bulk. The door closed again with a dull clang, and Agapito finally allowed himself to look at the prisoner, disgust welling up from the pit of his stomach. His name was Iato Kura, and he had come to the Raven Guard shortly after the Edict of Nicaea to ensure the ban on the librarians was enforced. Like others of his kind throughout the legions, he had been an unpopular figure, an embodiment of outside interference that aggravated the independently minded Raven Guard. Despite this, Agapito had never had any personal argument against the man and had fought alongside him in several wars. The word-bearer's chaplain looked up at Korax's entrance, relief on his face.
"Lord Korax," he said, rising to his feet with a bow of the head, "I am glad you have returned to right this matter."
"Be silent," snapped the Primarch, causing the chaplain to flinch. "Sit down and do not speak."
"I have been patient thus far with your men, but—"
"Silence!"
Korax's roar flooded the room, causing Agapito's ears to ring. Kura fell into the chair, almost breaking it, stunned by the violence of the Primarch's outburst.
"You are a traitor," said Korax,
his voice now dipping to an angered whisper, more intimidating than his shout.
"You are an enemy of the Emperor."
Kura opened his mouth and then quickly closed it as the Primarch's frown grew even deeper.
"Your Primarch is a cowardly, treacherous worm," Korax continued, crouching down so that his face was centimetres from that of the chaplain. "Your legion are worthless scum, whose false praises of the Emperor ring even hollower than ever. Your fellow chaplains are either dead or fled."
Fighting against the urge to retort to such accusations, Kura squirmed in the chair, mouthing wordless defences.
"Why did you not come to Istvan?"
demanded Korax.
"It was not my place," replied the chaplain. "It was better that I remained here to continue my instruction of the Legion's recruits. You agreed with that proposal, Lord?"
"Convenient for you. Very convenient that you were not there when your Legion opened fire on my warriors, cutting them down from behind."
"They did what?"
Kura looked aghast at the thought and shook his head.
"No, that is impossible."
"There are 75,000 Raven Guard corpses as evidence of its possibility," snarled Korax. "How long have you been planning your betrayal, Iato? Since the Emperor slapped Lorgar back into place, before then?"
"I am a chaplain dedicated to the spread of the Imperial truth," replied Kura. I was dispatched to Deliverance by the Edict of Malkador to ensure the Emperor's will was being done.
More lies. You were sent by Lorgar to spy on us, to pervert my warriors to the cause of Horus.
That is not true. What evidence do you possess that I am anything but a loyal servant of the Emperor? I have been with your legion since Nykaea. How can you hold me responsible for the actions of my Primarch?
Because you are a word-bearer. You speak with the tongue of Lorgar. That is your dark creed. You masquerade as the bearer of enlightenment, but you are nothing but an apostle of treachery.
You have no right to accuse...
Korak snatched up Kura by the throat, lifting him into the air, banging the chaplain's head against the ceiling.
Liar! Nothing but filthy lies spill from your bastard lips, son of Lorgar.
Agapito took a step forwards, but was stopped by Solaro's hand on his arm. The other commander silently shook his head. Kura's gasping face grew redder and redder as the Primarch's grip tightened.
"This is my world, my legion," rasped Korax. "You pollute both with your presence."
There was a loud crack, and Kura's head flopped to one side. Neck snapped. Korax growled wordlessly and lowered the limp corpse back into the chair. He turned back towards the door and stopped suddenly as he saw Agapito and Solaro. The Primarch's face was deathly white, his eyes black pits. Agapito felt a moment of trepidation as he looked at his lord's twisted snarl.
"Throw this filth in a furnace," said Korax.
He closed his eyes and visibly calmed, some of the blood returning to his face.
"I want his quarters searched again. If there is anything to connect him to Horus's plans, I want it found. Check his communications logs to see if he was contacted by Lorgar or any of the other word-bearers within the last year."
"Should we not have done that before his execution?" asked Solaro.
Agapito drew in a sharp breath, detecting a hint of annoyance in the tone of the other commander.
"To what end?" said Korax.
"Proof of his guilt, as he demanded," said Solaro.
The commander met the Primarch's gaze without fear, hands clasped respectfully in front of him.
"We cannot take the risk of allowing a traitor in our ranks. Besides, I could smell the taint on him now that I know what it is," said Korax.
He looked at Agapito.
"You saw what had become of the word-bearers on Istvan."
"I saw things that I wish I never had," replied Agapito. "The word-bearers were only one amongst many such."
"If you are blind to it, I must open your eyes," said the Primarch. "Too long have we kept this secret. It was the Emperor's will, but that no longer matters. He underestimated its threat."
"What are you saying, Lord?" said Solaro. "What threat?"
Korax blinked rapidly with surprise and wiped a hand across his face. His expression of torment had gone when he removed his pale hand, replaced by a saner look.
"Nothing. I am not... My judgment is clouded," said Korax.
He opened the door but turned his head as he stepped through.
"Send Bran to me. We must prepare the recruits."
When the Primarch was gone, Solaro gave Agapito a strange look.
"What was that about? What stench?" asked the commander.
"Must be a Primarch thing," replied Agapito. "I smell nothing here except the sweat of a dead man. You go and fetch Bran. I'll deal with this."
Agapito spent several minutes looking at Kura's corpse after Solaro had left, thinking about what the Primarch had said. Solaro was indeed blind to it, perhaps had not seen the taint. But Agapito knew what Korax had referred to. The taint had a name he had heard whispered for the first time on Istvan. Chaos. Radfires flickered blue at the heart of the mangled city, turning the ruddy sky purple with their blaze. The ruin stretched for dozens of kilometres, silhouettes like broken teeth jutting against the glow. For nearly a century, the fires had burned, a warning to Kievan not to return to its despicable past. The impact site was a cratered bowl of glass, levelled in an instant by the atomic mining charges the rebels had dropped down the gravity well. The stump of the orbital elevator remained as a twisted upthrust of solidified slurry that pointed accusingly at Lycaeus above. Further out, the buildings had survived, though some were little more than molten piles of rubble and slag.
Gas pockets and ruptured fuel lines added their own sporadic glare to the scene, brightening the dead landscape with flashes of white-hot Promethean plumes and clouds of venting vapour that oxidized into flurries of green and orange before dissipating into the polluted atmosphere. With no buildings to break it, the wind raged, scouring the ruins with hurricane force, adding its own erosion to the destruction wrought by the improvised nuclear bombs. Bridges over glowing rivers of molten ferrocrete swayed dangerously, their metallic creaks and groans an eerie cry in the desolation. Stairwells ascended into thin air, where once stratoscrapers had soared towards the heavens. Foundry cooling pools had become rad lakes, tumbled aqueducts spilt forth sluggish rivers that oozed rather than flowed along sheer-sided ravines that had once been the streets of Nerhub. Into this crawled a convoy of armoured vehicles, their broad tracks churning through the dust and ash. Each vehicle was low and broad, carried on four independent sets of tracks. The wind keen from their heavily riveted hulls and whipped communication aerials back and forth. They were marked with the symbols of the Mechanicum, but the armoured legionaries manning the open defence cupolas showed the livery to be a deception. Five in all, the transports advanced slowly, the lead vehicle picking its way over the piles of rubble, grinding and crushing brick and ferrocrete beneath its bulk. Alpharius manned a turret on the foremost rad crawler, twin heavy bolters on the pintle in front of him. Despite the ruin, the rad zone was not without its inhabitants, both humanoid and otherwise. He had been surprised by talk of guilders hiding out in the wastes, protected by flimsy rad domes and force shelters. Korax had left it to the Mechanicum to clear the last remnants of the old authorities eager to join the Great Crusade. That the Mechanicum had been lax in their prosecution of the Guild survivors would no doubt be of great benefit to the Alpha Legion's task here. One building stood proud amongst the debris of the old war. Swathed with noxious fog, it stood three stories high, slab-sided like a hangar, and bore the sigil of the Raven Guard. Armoured towers at each end followed the advance of the vehicles with batteries of las cannons. "Raven Delve in sight," Commander Agapito reported over the box. It was a training facility used by the Raven Guard to conduct war games in the nuclear wasteland. Sometimes the recruits were sent out against the separatist camps that still eked out an existence in the heart of the atomic carnage. It was here that Korax had chosen to set up his new facility, away from the eyes of the Mechanicum. It was a good choice for seclusion, and with news of Horus's treachery bound to have reached Kievar, it struck Alpharius as good cover for the Gene Tech Laboratory. Those few who might notice would not be surprised at an increase of activity here. There was an outer wall guarding the compound 10 meters high. Armoured gates slid aside to allow the vehicles to enter and then ground shut when the last transport had passed. Radiation detectors in Alpharius's suit flashed from green to a warning amber for a moment as they passed along the road to the building, a rad pocket. He had no concerns for his safety. Even without his armour, his modified body was capable of withstanding the levels of nuclear pollution in the area. Further into the wastes would be a different matter, and as the transporter shuddered to a halt in the shadow of Raven Delve, he wondered again how the dissidents could survive at all. Covered by the defences of the station, the Raven Guard disembarked and formed up beside their vehicles, while Korax, Agapito and Bran headed into the facility. The hydraulic ramps on the side of each transport lowered, and they began the process of unloading their precious cargo. Alpharius had noticed something particular about the force sent down to Kievar when they had boarded the strike cruiser that had brought them here. They were all from the Vault expedition. Clearly, Korax trusted only those he was forced to, with the knowledge of the Gene Tech. There were no serfs, only legionaries, the most trustworthy of the Emperor's servants. The only exceptions were the Tech Priest and his servitors, who were essential to the project. The Alpha Legionnaire wondered what story had been told to the rest of the Raven Guard to explain the goings-on on the world below. Secrets made Alpharius happy. In secrecy, Korax hoped to rebuild his legion, but secrets were the favoured battleground of the Alpha Legion. The Raven Guard were entering alien territory now and would be made to pay for their inexperience. Secrecy created its own problems of communication and would ultimately hamper Korax. The Primarch had stepped into a twilight world of misdirection and would be made to pay for the mistake. The increased security did not bother Alpharius now. He was already one of a trusted few. The Raven Guard feared their secret would be discovered and would bend their efforts to maintaining the falsehood, not knowing that their security had already been compromised and the enemy lurked within. The interior of Ravendelve was far larger than Alpharius had expected. It burrowed into the ground for several more levels. He followed the rest of the squad down a ramp toward the sublevels. A motorized trolley steered in front of him into the bowels of the facility. Most of the space was taken up with the dorm rooms for recruits and legionaries sent here on exercise, empty for the moment, with the rest taken up by a huge drill hall and firing ranges.
"Where are you going?"
Alpharius froze at the sound of Bran's voice. He looked over his shoulder to see the commander of recruits and his brother standing at a doorway he had just passed, the twinkling lights of command consoles winking behind them.
"Pardon, Commander,"
said Alpharius, not sure what was expected of him.
"That crate, it's clearly marked for the infirmary," continued Bran. "What are you doing down here? We don't have the luxury of time to dawdle about." "Have you lost your way?"
asked Agapito, a smile on his lips. The unease of Alpharius increased dramatically as he realized the two commanders were expecting him to change direction and head towards the infirmary there and then. He had no idea where it was. His eyes scoured the walls for any sign or markings that might indicate its location. There was nothing to aid him. He looked back at Agapito and Bran, something like desperation surfacing in his thoughts.
"You can share the elevator with me,"
a voice called down the corridor. Alpharius swung around and saw the white armor of Vincente VI, an apothecary he had met after infiltrating the Legion on Istvan V. He was standing at the open door of a conveyor in a small vestibule behind Alpharius.
"Good idea," said Alpharius, breathing a sigh of relief.
He thumbed the motor of the trolley into life and guided it towards the waiting apothecary, who slid the door closed behind him as Alpharius brought his trolley to a stop on the metal floor of the elevator.
"I know how you feel,"
said Six, pulling a lever to send the elevator ascending to the upper levels.
"It seems like an age since I was last here. Can barely remember where anything is."
"Too true,"
said Alpharius. A thought occurred to him.
"I don't remember you from the expedition on Terra."
"No, I stayed on the Avenger," said Six. "I'm chief apothecary now, though, so the Primarch couldn't well start all of this gene tech business without bringing me in. To be honest, even the little of what I've seen is way beyond anything I know. Nexin, the tech priest, will be doing most of the work. I'm just here to liaise."
"A solemn duty," said Alpharius, "and a great responsibility."
"One I am entirely unprepared for," said Six, without any hint of humour. "My brother apothecaries suffered badly at the drop site. It would appear that the traitors set out to target us from the outset. Only 7 of us got back. And even with only 15 years in the Apothecarian, it seems I'm the longest serving. Now I'm supposed to be running the whole project."
"I'm sure Korax has every confidence in you."
The elevator rattled to a halt, and Alpharius dragged open the door.
"We're all depending on you, Six. You won't let us down."
"The infirmary's this way," said the apothecary, pointing to the right.
"Yes, it's coming back to me now," said Alpharius.
"Thanks for the help. Let me know if I can return the favour." "I'll find plenty for you to do, have no worry about that," said Six. "If even half of what Nexin says is true, there'll be no shortage of work for everyone. Rebuilding a legion is going to be hard work."
Not as hard as it was to destroy one, thought Alpharius, as he followed the apothecary along the passageway. Holding the electro-welder delicately between his fingertips, Straedon Binalt used his other hand to hold the vent vein in place. Sparks erupted onto his skin, already pockmarked by dozens of similar burns, but the work was so delicate he could not use protective gauntlets. The pain was momentary, barely registered. The weld complete, he put his tools aside and leaned back on his stool to admire his work. From the other workshops around him came the clatter of pneumatics and the crackle of spark bonders. The smell of ceramite adhesive was thick. The primitive air filtration systems of Ravenspire's lower levels unable to cope with the vast quantities of the vapour being released by the work of the armourers. The armorium of Ravenspire was far better equipped than that of the Avenger, and progress had been relatively swift since the return to deliverance. He hoped it was swift enough, From what he had heard of the progress on the new gene tech, Lord Korax might be leading the Legion to war again within a few dozen days. He twisted the nozzle across both axes, satisfied with the freedom of movement on the joints. Picking up a rag, he wiped away a small residue on the fuel inlet valves and lifted the vent into place.
"You said you had something to show me."
Binout drew a protective covering over his work as he stood up and turned to see Commander Agapito at the door.
"Yes, Commander," said Binout. "Follow me."
He led Agapito between the open-fronted workshops, where his fellow tech marines and their non-enhanced assistants labored in the glare of fluorescent tubes and welding sparks. Rows upon rows of shoulder plates and reinforced greaves hung on the walls. More complete suits of armor were being assembled in a larger space attached to the armorium, where a small army of servitors and attendants worked to fit power cabling and life support systems into the refurbished suits.
"This way," Binot directed the commander to a solid blast door on the left.
The tech marine punched in a security code on the pad, and the door lifted out of view with a wheeze of hydraulics. Beyond was the test firing range. Lights flickered into life as they entered to reveal a narrow space 100 meters long, painted white, overlaid with a grid of thin red lines. At the far end stood three suits of armor in front of a wall heavily cracked and pockmarked by impacts. Binout turned to a rack on the right and lifted up a bolter. He took out a box of rounds from a shelf underneath and loaded the weapon before handing it to Agapito.
"Target the left suit," said the tech marine. "Go for one of the shoulder plates."
Agapito hefted the bolter up and aimed. With a cough of the launching charge, he fired, the bolt round flaring into life for a second as it raced down the hall. It struck the left shoulder pad of the empty suit. There was another detonation, the crack echoing back down to the two space marines. Shards of ceramite scattered across the firing range, but as the dust cleared, the shoulder pad was shown to be mostly intact.
"That is one of our standard rounds, against Mark IV armor," said Binot. "As you can see, the effect is limited."
"Yes, I can see that," said Agapito.
"Yet at the Urgal massacre, the traitors cut down thousands of legionaries with their bolters," continued Binot.
The word sounded cold, but he remembered painfully the sight and sound of his fellow Raven Guard butchered in the ambush. He had felt helpless, the rounds from his bolt pistol barely scratching the armor of the traitors while their weapons cut through the Raven Guard without mercy.
"I recovered pieces, fragments of the ammunition used by the enemy, from the armor of legionaries who withdrew successfully."
Taking the bolter from Agapito, Binout swapped the magazine for another and gave the weapon back to the commander.
"I was also able to procure a few experimental rounds our brothers in the Imperial Fist secured from Mars before it was embroiled by division. We haven't got the facilities to replicate them here, but I think I have devised a close approximation."
Agapito sighted again and fired. This time the other shoulder pad of the armor erupted into spinning fragments and droplets of molten ceramite.
"Vengeance," muttered the commander.
He lowered the bolter and looked at the tech marine.
"This is impressive, but also profoundly worrying. It means that the traitors had access to Martian developments before Istvan."
"The roots of the rebellion have delved deeply, Commander,"
Binout agreed with a somber nod.
"We are not without countermeasures. Please fire at the central suit."
The middle stand held one of the suits that had been modified by Binout's multiplate reinforced shoulder pads. This time, Agapito's shot caught the armor's shoulder guard flush on the rim. As with the last shot, there was a great explosion of debris, but as the ringing died down, both Raven Guard could clearly see that only the outer layer of armor had been shredded. The inner plating was intact. Agapito was quiet, staring at the armored mannequins at the far end of the hall. He distractedly handed the bolter back to Binot, attention still fixed on the damaged suits.
"What is the matter, Commander?" asked the tech marine. "Is something not satisfactory?"
"I killed at least 100 space marines on Istvan," Agapito said quietly. "They were Legionis Astartes, just like us. Something I'd never thought I would have to do."
The commander shook his head abruptly, breaking his distant stare. "This war will not end easily. We must all get used to the idea now." Thunder pealed from Therion's dark clouds, and lightning split the violet evening sky, glittering from the glass walls of the great conservatory.
10,000 panes of glass reflected the tumult in the heavens, bright even against the lights that glowed within. The hippocamps snorted mist in the cold, their shaggy coats thick with moisture, as the coach driver urged them on through the strengthening rain. The road ahead was fast becoming a stream, water flowing down from the tree-lined embankments that flanked it as it speared across the estate towards the sprawling mansion. The driver was swathed in oilskins, only his nose and eyes visible as he turned to speak into the grill on the body of the carriage behind him.
"Almost there, Prefector," said Palon, voice muffled.
"Very good, Palon," came Valerius's tinny reply.
The Therion's servant pulled up the lapels of his heavy coat and adjusted the cord under his chin that kept his broad hat from being whisked away by the wind. It was not an ideal arrangement, but Valerius had been adamant that they depart for his father's palace as soon as possible. The rare storm had prevented them taking an airfoil, and a noble of Therion would never be seen travelling in a gas cart, leaving the far more traditional means of the coach as the only option. Broad tired wheels hissed through the puddles as Palon slowed the carriage to negotiate a small bridge that humped over a foaming stream. The hippocamps were controlled by a small box set into a pedestal beside the driver. As his deft fingers moved the levers, pressure bladders in the creature's harnesses reacted to the radio signal, inflating or deflating in sequence to guide the creatures left and right, urge them on, or quell their momentum. The gate ahead was open already, and they passed beneath the arch of silver wrought as two coiling serpents, the ruling crest of Therion.
"Take us straight to the west entrance," Valerius instructed over the tannoy.
Palon steered the carriage over the gravel of the compound, the clawed feet of the hippocamps throwing up stones to clatter against the bottom of the driving board. He brought them to a halt and then guided them forward step by step until the carriage door was level with the raised brick walkway that led up to the columned entrance to the great conservatory. Many of the windows were open despite the tempest. Palon saw the telltale glimmer of weather shields glowing around the open frames. The sound of music and conversation could just be heard over the rain. Palon engaged the brakes and dropped the anchor lines over the haunches of the hippocamps before twisting in his seat to disengage the door lock. With a puff of pneumatics, the door swung open. Palon dragged out a large rain canopy from under his seat and jumped down to the walkway in time for Valerius to step out under the vast umbrella.
"Seems there's a bit of a party going on," remarked Valerius
as he strode up the rain-soaked pathway, Palon trotting along beside, struggling to keep hold of the red and white canopy acting as a sail in the wind.
"Your niece's birthday, Prefector," said Palon.
"Which one?"
"Darius's youngest, Nicella," replied Palon.
"Oh, her," said Valerius. "Such a pretty young thing."
"Not so young now, Prefector," said Palon.
They reached the short flight of steps that led up to the entranceway.
"She's 6 years old now, a woman, not a girl."
"What's that in Terran?" said the Prefector as he mounted the steps. "I don't see why you insist on using the old calendar, Palon."
"Because it served us well enough for 80 generations before compliance," thought Palon. But instead he said,
"That would be roughly 17 Terran years, Prefector."
"Time passes so quickly,"
observed Valerius as they passed under the glass awning of the entrance. Liveried servants took the umbrella from Palon and sponged down Valerius's moist uniform without comment. They carried themselves with the easy manner of men who had served in the cohort, and the skull buttons on the lapels attested to the fact. They made no inquiry of the new arrivals and silently stepped aside to allow the pair entry. That Valerius wore the red sash of the Therion elite was proof enough of his right to attend the function, for an impostor to wear the red was the only capital crime left on Therion. Palon led the way across the deep carpets, the rain rattling on the canopy of glass above their heads. More attendants waited at the doors to the conservatory with gold trays holding spiral-stemmed glasses of wine. Palon appropriated one for his master, but the Prefector declined the drink with a wave of his hand and stepped through the door. Palon downed the glass's contents in one gulp and placed it back on the tray with a wink, earning himself a scowl of disapproval from the servants. Valerius's manservant was not the least worried about their disapproval. As simple household servants, they were far below an attendant to a Prefector in the informal hierarchy of the serving class. He followed a respectful distance behind Valerius as the Prefector made his way across the conservatory.
The festivities were in full swing. Gaily dressed women, with jewelled hairpieces, twirled and curtsied as they danced with men decked out in their fine uniforms, braided and brocaded with gold, a whirl of sparkling colour and gems. Chandeliers hanging from the white-painted iron of the conservatory lit all with a soft blue glow, adding to the unreal atmosphere. On a small side stage, a quintet played a tune on hunt flutes and rintars, the slow tempo of their piece dictating the whole rhythm of the partygoers. Even those not dancing seemed to congregate and separate in time to the beat, taking measured paces with each skirl and strum. Valerius was not in time to this rhythm, hurrying toward a set of spiral stairs that led to a gallery overlooking the proceedings. The prefector kept bumping into people or dodging to avoid them at the last moment, so his progress became a series of faltering steps, punctuated by bowed apologies. Palon closed the gap and assisted his master, picking up dislodged hats, dropped scabbards and canes, and smoothing ruffled skirts and jacket sleeves in Valerius's wake. A broad-chested man with thick sideburns and beetling eyebrows emerged from the throng just in front of Valerius. He wore a red and black sash over his blue uniform, indicating he had served with a cohort but was no longer a licensed officer. He slapped a hand to Valerius's shoulder, almost knocking the surprised prefector from his feet.
"Marcus!"
boomed the man, who Palon now recognized as Raulius Tibalian, one of the distant family cousins. He was much larger of gut and jowl than when Palon had last seen him, which had been at least 5 Terran years before. "I'm sorry, I have to speak urgently with my father," said Valerius, pushing past. Tibalian turned to one of his companions with a scowl.
"Apologies, Equitabalian. My master has very pressing concerns to discuss with the Caesari," Palon said hurriedly as he came level with the man. "I'm sure the prefector will find time to reacquaint himself with you soon."
Valerius's progress had caused quite a stir, rippling out from his path like a bow wave of distraction. Tibalian and several others followed him to the spiral stair, the crowd growing to nearly a dozen by the time the prefector was mounting the wrought iron steps. Palon made his way through the press with as little shoving as possible and ran up the stairs to catch his master. The ruling dignitaries of Therion sat on low couches overlooking the floor of the conservatory, even more marvellous in their finery than those below. The band finished playing and the half-dozen members of Valerius's family rose to their feet with polite applause.
"Look, father, Marcus is here."
This came from a woman a little older than the prefector, his sister, Myania. All eyes turned towards him as he stepped up to the gallery balustrade, tucking his helmet under one arm as he presented himself with a short bow. "Caesari," said the prefector, eyes fixed on the plushly carpeted floor.
"Prefector,"
replied his father with equal formality. Caesari Valentinus Valerius was one of the youngest to hold the office, just over 17 years old, in his late 50s as Terrans measured time. He was even shorter and slighter than his eldest son, clean-shaven, with thinning blonde hair that was pulled back in a short knot at the base of his skull. His uniform was bedecked with frogging and medals, honours he had rightfully earned in the Therian cohort, alongside the Emperor and Raven Guard. The Caesari extended his hand in greeting, the thumb and two other digits replaced by mechanical augmetics. Likewise, his right ear was a prosthetic device, and he stood slightly lopsided on his bionic leg. Marcus took the hand and briefly pursed his lips to his father's knuckles before straightening.
"Welcome back to Therion, my son,"
declared the Caesari, embracing Marcus tightly.
"Do not hoard him to yourself,"
said Juliana, the Caesari's wife. She prized her husband's arms from her son and replaced them with her own, planting an audible kiss on the prefector's cheek.
"I have important news," said Marcus, freeing himself from his mother's grip.
Palon glanced over the balcony to see that the partygoers were all paying attention to what passed amongst the ruling family. Glasses were held halfway to lips. Conversations had dried away.
"Get yourself a drink, Marcus,"
said Antonius, the younger of the Caesari's two sons. He looked like a fairer-headed version of his older brother, save for the pockmark of a bullet scar on the right side of his chin.
"Why so glum?" "Yes, son, settle and tell us what you've been up to," said Juliana, lifting up a wine glass from a shelf set upon the balustrade. "It's been such a long time."
"Horus has rebelled against the Emperor."
The Prefector's blurted words carried far across the conservatory, hushing the few discussions that had continued. From below came the clatter of metal and shattering of glass as a servant spilled his tray in shock.
"What did you say?"
demanded the Caesari.
What do you mean?"
"The sons of Horus are traitors," said Marcus. He snatched the glass from his mother's hand with trembling fingers and swallowed the contents. When he continued, it was in a whisper. "The War Master seeks to overthrow the Emperor. Many of the Legiones Astartes have sided with Lupercal. There is going to be civil war."
"This must be a mistake," said Juliana. "Perhaps some of his legion, but Horus himself?"
"What of the Raven Guard?" asked the Caesari.
"This makes no sense," said Antonius.
"Are you sure?"
"It happened at Isfahan," said the Prefector, the muscles in his jaw clenching at the memory. "I saw what happened. I and a handful of others are all that remains of the Therian cohort. The Raven Guard, they are loyal. Lord Korax sent me here. They were all but destroyed. And it looks as if the traitors finished the job on the Salamanders and Iron Hands." The Caesari slumped back onto his couch, face as white as snow, mouth open in dumb shock. Palon heard the chattering on the main floor and saw some of the guests heading towards the doors. He cautiously tugged at the elbow of his master's coat.
"Prefector, might I make a suggestion?"
"Be quiet, Palon," said Marcus, pulling away his arm.
"Some of the guests are leaving,"
Palon said, pointing across the conservatory.
"Rumours, master, can be damaging."
"Your man's right," said Antonius. He turned to the Caesari.
"Father, if this news spreads in the wrong way, it'll cause hysteria and panic."
The Caesari beckoned with a raised hand, and his chief counsellor, Tribune Pellis, rose from his seat at the far end of the gallery.
"Nobody is to leave yet," said Valentinus. "Confiscate all personal communication devices. Not until we've drafted an official proclamation. That includes servants. Have the veterans stationed at every exit. I want nobody coming in or out until I say otherwise."
Pellis nodded wordlessly and withdrew. The Caesari was recovering from the shock and stood up. He gave Marcus a troubled glance and then began to pace, circling around the couch.
"I assume Korax sent you to raise a new cohort," he said, receiving a nod of affirmation from his son. "Manpower shouldn't be a problem. We've been turning away volunteers for the last 2 years. We'll need ships to replace the losses, though."
"Natal Prime, there's a fleet there," said Antonius. "Old ships returning with the Natal regiments. But they'll serve well enough if you send word to the council there."
"Yes, and we can get help from the Forge World at, what's the damn place called?"
"Some of the Mechanicum have allied with Horus," Marcus said before the question could be answered.
"You mean Beta Cornix, father. Best to make sure which side they are on before you go to them."
The Caesari stopped in his tracks and was again struck dumb for a moment with distress at this news, his expression almost imploring his son to retract what he had said. The unease passed in a few seconds, and the Caesari continued his striding.
"That will make weapons acquisition a problem," said Valentinus.
"The forges of Kievar can supply any shortfall," said the Prefector.
"Good, good. I'll have Pellis start the muster first thing in the morning. We can sort out the details once the initial orders have been dispatched."
The Caesari stopped and gripped the rail. Below, servants were herding the guests towards the main building, corralling them like hippocamps. A musician protested loudly as he was manhandled from the stage, waving his lyre pipe above his head like a regimental banner.
"Anything else we need to decide now?"
"The commander," said Juliana. "You're not leaving Therion to go running off to war, not at a time like this."
The Caesari's expression sagged with disappointment as he nodded. His lips twitched for a second or two while he considered the problem. Valentina smiled and looked at Marcus again.
"Well, no need to look too far, is there, my son?" said the Therian ruler.
He slapped a hand to the Prefector's shoulder.
"You know more about what is happening than any of us. You can lead the cohort."
"I am honoured, father, but I am only a Prefector," said Marcus.
"Nonsense. I'm in charge. You're Vice Caesari now, full authority. Antonius will take over as Prefector."
Marcus shook his head in disbelief, mouth opening and closing several times before he remembered his station. He dropped to one knee and took his father's hand, kissing the knuckles.
"I will serve,"
he said, speaking the oath words of the cohort, "for the Emperor above all others, for Therion and enlightenment." Palon suppressed a smile. Being servant to a prefector was one thing, being aide to a vice Caesari was something far grander. If he was lucky, and he could see no reason why he didn't deserve a piece of luck, he might even be made a sub-tribune to recognize his status.
"Ensure your master's rooms are ready," Juliana said to Palon. "Without warning of his arrival, I have no idea what state they're in."
With a bow, Palon accepted the slight admonishment and withdrew. Even as a sub-tribune, he would still have to fold down the sheets. It gave him comfort to think that there were some things in life that even the treachery of a war master could not change.